Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hillary Clinton captured headlines this week after she appeared to nearly collapse after leaving a 9/11 memorial ceremony in New York. She said she felt overheated. Her doctor later revealed that Clinton had been diagnosed with pneumonia the previous Friday. Pneumonia has a long and deadly history, but it is common. 2 million Americans are diagnosed with a mild form every year, and it is very treatable. Joining us by phone is Cleveland Clinic pulmonologist Dr. Wang Tuong. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
What exactly is pneumonia? Why are there some weaker forms or stronger forms and that kind of a thing?
That's a great question. So pneumonia is defined as an infection of the lung tissue itself. So deep inside the chest, where there are millions and millions of air sacs inside our lungs that do the job of getting oxygen from the air into our blood, have been dealt an infection. And so we most commonly call that a pneumonia. But there are, as you've mentioned, differing levels or different severities of pneumonias, and a lot depends on how healthy a patient is at the time of that they get a pneumonia. So the very young, who may not have fully developed immune systems, or the very elderly, who may have weaker immune systems or are more prone to severe pneumonias, whereas maybe a person with no other medical history or medical conditions can kind of power through a pneumonia without too much trouble. And it also depends on the infection itself, too, if it's a virus or if it's a bacteria that's causing a pneumonia.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about pneumonia. What is it? How is it treated? And why does it last is harder on some people than others? My guest is Dr. Wang Tuong. He's a pulmonologist at the Cleveland Clinic. If you have a question about pneumonia, give us a call right now, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How can you... Can pneumonia, it's an infection. Can it come from a common cold? Can it come from an allergy? Where does it come from?
Well, certainly the symptoms could start off similar to what you would experience with allergies and a common cold. So typically you may start off with maybe feeling run down, you know, maybe a low-grade fever, a cough, then certainly could develop into a pneumonia. You know, allergies tend to be a separate process, but certainly the symptoms could be similar at the very beginning and then develop into the pneumonia. Where pneumonias come from? Well, there's, you know, we're surrounded by, you know, viruses and bacteria in the air and in droplets, and in our day-to-day lives as we go about from home to school to work, we could easily become exposed. Most of us, though, have good immune systems that can handle these viruses or these bacteria, and usually it's of little consequence. But for somebody with a weaker immune system, that infection could certainly develop.
Are there seasons of pneumonia?
Well, the classic pneumonia that's seasonal is influenza.
Okay.
So influenza comes up more so during the winter months. Actually, flu season is right around the corner, so it's a great time to remind folks to look into getting a flu shot if they qualify. But influenza is the main one that we associate with being seasonal. The other pneumonias or common colds could certainly happen any time of the year. We tend to notice an increase during the winter months, but I do believe the risk is the same throughout the year.
Can you recover from pneumonia without an antibiotic, like on your own, or is it always called for?
That's a great question. So I would say a lot of patients who are healthy, who are not hospitalized, are able to recover without the use of antibiotics, especially if we know that the pneumonia is caused by a virus. So if it's a viral infection like influenza, antibiotics won't help treat that infection. But if it's a bacterial pneumonia, if your doctor suspects a bacterial pneumonia, then antibiotics are definitely called for and will definitely help.
Do different kinds of pneumonia present differently if it's a bacterial or a viral?
It can be hard to tell the difference because there's a lot of overlap in the symptoms. So both a viral pneumonia and a bacterial pneumonia can start out the same with the cough and the phlegm and the fevers. So it can be hard to tease out, even for physicians as they're talking and to patients and examining them. It's tough. They're not necessarily based on the history and physical ways to tell, but if we are doing more invasive testing, especially for our hospitalized patients, that involves blood tests or cultures of the phlegm, then we might be able to figure out if it's more viral or bacterial.
What's the difference between pneumonia and walking pneumonia?
So that's another great question. So the term, you know, walking pneumonia has its roots in a very specific bacteria. So there's a bacteria called Mycoplasma. It's a very common one. And when a pneumonia is caused by this bacteria, most patients will have the kind of traditional symptoms like a cough and phlegm and fever, but they're still able to go about their day-to-day activities and maybe still get through work or get through classes and do what they want to do and gradually recover. So nowadays we use that term much more loosely, and I think it's applied to a lot of patients who, again, may have all the classic symptoms of a pneumonia, but don't feel that run down and can still go about their day-to-day activities. It's probably not that different from the more classic term of regular pneumonia, which would just be an infection of the lung, and some patients may be especially run down by that infection and may need to rest at home to recover, or in more rare cases may need to be hospitalized for IV antibiotics.
One time when I was diagnosed with pneumonia, the physician said to me, "Doesn't it hurt to breathe?" And I had not gone to her for that purpose. And I said, "No, it doesn't hurt me to breathe at all." Do people feel it differently?
I do think that patients will feel it differently because every patient's different, and also every pneumonia is a little different. So the extent to which a pneumonia has infected the lungs and the extent to how a patient is responding to that will vary. And so for some patients, they may not notice much at all except for just a dry cough.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be other patients that, as you mentioned, it may hurt to breathe because it's affected the lung tissue and may start to affect some of the chest wall tissue as well. And that could cause some of the pain in very severe pneumonias.
Why the deadly history of pneumonia? Is that a certain kind that's more dangerous than others?
You're right. There is a long history of deadly pneumonias, and especially, you know, for infections where we didn't have good treatments for. So, for example, you know, the development of antibiotics has certainly been a major benefit to the treatment of pneumonias. The development of vaccines and to the ability to rapidly develop vaccines in response to new pneumonias as well has also been very helpful in our ability to make pneumonia a less deadly disease. So there have been advancements in technology and in pharmaceuticals that have helped us manage pneumonias, and also a better understanding of public health and hygiene, so that we know that you know, frequent hand washing and cleaning, you know, services that are used frequently will help reduce the risk of transmitting these infections. So yes, there's definitely been a long history of deadly pneumonias, but I think we've been fortunate to have a lot of advancements to help us manage pneumonias and reduce their incidence.
How contagious is it?
Well, a lot depends on the type of pneumonia, the virus or the bacteria that's causing it. So some are probably more contagious than others, and notably influenza. Mm-hmm. And so that goes to frequent hand washing and good hygiene to reduce the transmission of these bugs.
When you talk about influenza, is mm-hmm. influenza, whatever type it is, is it always considered a form of pneumonia?
It is.
Okay.
It is. So when you have influenza and it gets into your lungs, it's causing an infection, and yes, usually we call that a pneumonia.
Pneumonia can be defined according to its location in the lung. How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So you could certainly have pneumonia in one lung or in both lungs, or the upper part of your lungs or the lower part of your lungs. That certainly depends on where this infection has decided to go. In general, the treatment's going to be the same, though, which if it's a bacterial pneumonia would be antibiotics. And then a lot of what we call supportive care, so a lot of staying hydrated and drinking a lot of fluids and rest if needed.
I can't imagine that smoking doesn't influence or exacerbate any kind of respiratory infection. Does it influence the likelihood of getting one?
It does. It does. Smoking does. It just, you know, as you inhale everything that comes with smoking, it damages the lining of the lungs and weakens its ability to respond to an infection. So active smoking is certainly a risk factor for pneumonias and can also prolong a patient's recovery from a pneumonia as well.
How do you know that it's time to go see a physician when you have the symptoms that you've been talking about, Dr. Tuong?
Yeah, so I would say for a healthy person who doesn't have any medical diseases, I would say if within a couple of days, if they don't feel like they're on the mend from these, from having, you know, a cough or some phlegm or having a fever, that would be time to reach out to a medical provider. If there's a patient with a more extensive medical history or medical diseases or taking several medications, maybe at the first signs of having a fever or cough, that might be an appropriate time to reach out to either their physician or a specialist they may be seeing for a certain condition.
Are some people more prone to, besides smokers, more prone, like once you get pneumonia, you have a better chance of getting it again?
Yeah, it depends on
the type.
Yeah, the type of pneumonia and each patient, too, in terms of how, you know, healthy they are and how robust they are at the time they get the pneumonia. So, you know, the patients who are either very young or, you know, very elderly or have a lot of medical conditions do have a risk of having a pneumonia come back again. They just are also at increased risk of getting the pneumonia in the first place.
Why are fluids such a big deal when it comes to treating pneumonia?
Sure. So as we go through a pneumonia, a lot of us, the patient is typically breathing a little bit faster, and as you exhale more, you're breathing a lot of water vapor. So you're losing fluids in that sense. And as your body is responding to an infection, your heart rate picks up and it's wanting to send blood to all parts of your body to make sure there's enough oxygen getting everywhere. So there's a natural tendency for dehydration to happen and for dehydration to occur. So we strongly recommend that patients drink a lot of fluids and do their best to stay hydrated.
Okay. Well, Dr. Wayne Tuong, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Wayne Tuong is a pulmonologist at the Cleveland Clinic. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the years following World War II, the U.S. suffered from a shortage of primary care doctors. That's when the nurse practitioner emerged. That category of nurse is qualified to treat certain medical conditions without the direct supervision of a doctor. But a current doctor shortage in the U.S. means more patients are now being seen by nurse practitioners. Today, 21 states, not including Ohio, have addressed the doctor shortage by allowing nurse practitioners to practice to the full extent of their training. There's also a question of whether they should be going into business for themselves in some circumstances. Joining us now is nurse practitioner at Ohio State University Hospitals East, Candy Reinhart. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Chief Innovation Officer at Ohio State University College of Nursing, Tim Radersdorf. Tim is also the founder and instructor of the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Workshop for Health Professionals, which is hosting its a workshop next week at the Ohio Union. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Candy, nurse practitioners haven't been around that long in the history of healthcare, and not even close to that long when it comes to Ohio. I know there were big battles at the State House for a long time over what a nurse practitioner should do and shouldn't do. When did their role start to evolve?
Well, actually, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary of nurse practitioners that began in Colorado in 1960s. And then our title recognition occurred in 1996, so in Ohio. So that was the beginning of nurse practitioners in Ohio. The role has evolved since then. I've been practicing for almost 20 years and have watched the role transcend and educated people on what a nurse practitioner can do. I think we've evolved mostly because of the need for more healthcare providers. And as you already mentioned, the baby boomers and the more people who will be needing care, there's a bigger need for providers.
Some people use their go to their nurse practitioner, I should say, as a primary care option.
Right. We have a clinic located at University Hospital East, and we call it a nurse-led clinic, where all the primary care providers are nurse practitioners. We have an interprofessional staff, too, with a pharmacist, social worker. We integrate behavioral health with, we have a psych NP, we have a dietitian, our in-care coordinator. We have a full team of providers, but the primary care provider is a nurse practitioner.
And nurse practitioners are also in specialties like endocrinology, gastroenterology, that kind of a thing.
And at Ohio State, you can be educated for different types of NPs so that you take your certification exam in that. So whether it's women's health, psych, peds, There's multiple routes that you can take, and then sit for a certification exam.
So what are the options then, Tim? When you're going to have this workshop, what are you talking about when it comes to entrepreneurship and nurse practitioners?
Yeah, so we're thinking of entrepreneurship and intrapreneurship, so people having the opportunity to be entrepreneurial within their workflow as well.
Okay.
So the goal of our workshop is to provide health practitioners, health professionals, with the tools and confidence to make informed decisions about taking the entrepreneurial leap or to be more innovative within their work practice.
Can you give me some examples of what you mean by that?
Sure. Actually, today is a perfect example for me. So I started off this morning working with a nurse out of our James Cancer Hospital who had an idea to improve a product that she uses every day. We sat down today with our technology commercialization office and talked to her about what patenting that product would look like and doing all the proper studies to make sure that a patent would be attainable. So it was, you know, it's something that nurses were not typically educated on. We're not really up to date on what that all looks like. So it's really important for us to recognize that there are, depending on the studies that you look at or the numbers that you look at, somewhere between 3 to 4 million nurses practicing on a daily basis in the U.S. So what we want to do is make sure that these nurses who are constantly at the bedside dealing with patient outcomes, recognizing the inefficiencies that we have in practice, know how to move that forward so that they're not just impacting their unit or the practices within the health system, but at a local to global mission.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about nurse practitioners and nurse practitioners as entrepreneurs, whether it's developing products or maybe opening up a shop of their own. If you have a question or comment, have you had an experience with a nurse practitioner? You want to talk about that and tell us what you thought? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Candy, you operate out of OSU Hospitals East.
Yes.
So you're affiliated strongly with Ohio State University.
Yes.
When we talk about somebody maybe opening up their own, it would be like somebody opening up their own doctor's office.
Correct.
But it'd be
a
nurse practitioner, a private practice. How common is that?
Well, in Ohio, it's not incredibly common because there are some laws right now that may inhibit that being financially viable for a nurse practitioner. That being said, there are people who have done it and have done it well. And actually, Candy is the one who developed the first one from scratch in Ohio.
Like, tell us about that, Candy.
I had a practice in Springfield, Ohio from 2004 to 2014 prior to coming here, where I owned and operated the practice. Our physician collaborator was off-site. We still have a physician collaborator as mm-hmm. Required by law, but the requirement isn't for the physician to be on-site. So, yeah, it was quite a successful practice and enjoyed it very much and would still be doing that, except I was asked to come here.
Another opportunity came up.
Right.
Well, tell me about, Tim mentioned there's some laws, Ohio mm-hmm. laws, that inhibit opening up private practices as nurse practitioners. How did you get around those? How did that work for you?
Well, one of the biggest barriers, I would call it, is the requirement for a standard care arrangement. And that's what you were talking about earlier when you said 21 states do not require any physician oversight.
Okay.
That is actually for our state, it's called collaboration and requires a standard care arrangement to be signed by a physician. And that means that you have a physician that you can contact, talk with at any time when you feel like you're outside your scope of practice, your education, your certification. Mm-hmm. So, but with that, I actually, in one of my other roles at Ohio State, have nurse practitioners and interprofessional staff and other sites outside of Franklin County, in mm-hmm. Franklin County with OSU and outside. But every time I find a nurse practitioner to take on a new role that's not ever been created before and we're trying a new thing, I also have to find a physician collaborator for them. And that is not so easy sometimes. Plus, we do are most often required to pay our physician collaborators. So that's an expense to the practice that you would have to include if you were to go and start your own practice. Hmm. So, and that's individual. There's not a common amount that is requested. It's all over the board as far as what people pay for their collaborator.
Tim Raidersdorf, where do you see the most opportunity when it comes to opening up private practices for nurse practitioners? Where is there the biggest demand?
I think it's universal, actually.
Okay.
So we know that in Ohio that we're going to have a physician shortage and actually across the U.S. in the next by 2025. We also know that we're going to have a primary care shortage at that time. So access to care is going to become a driving factor for us. Now, proponents of this would say, well, physicians can go to these rural areas and also care for those patients. And for us, that's a wonderful option. But we also want to be able to make sure that our nurse practitioners have that opportunity to care for those who may not have access to a physician or a nurse practitioner within their local community.
I imagine geriatrics will be a big specialty mm-hmm. by 2025, right?
Yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Geriatrics, critical care is going to continue to grow as we see our patients with multiple chronic conditions.
Living longer, therefore developing more longer chronic conditions.
Correct.
But access to care also means prevention and a healthier population if we have better access and preventative type care in our primary care, too.
So what have been the objections? 21 states have already eliminated the physician collaborator role, making it easier for nurse practitioners mm-hmm. to operate. In Ohio, is it just because Ohio is always the 25th to do anything or mm-hmm. what?
Well, we have legislation now, mm-hmm. House Bill 216, which is probably what you were referring to earlier. And within that, originally, we had asked for removal of our standard care arrangement. Primarily organized medicine is where there was the backlash, and where in order to get most of our legislation through, we had to take some concessions. Mm-hmm. And so the standard care arrangement continues in that legislation. But we made gains in other things that will help us be able to care for our patients.
And I wanted to get back to the thing that you said you were talking about. Is it earlier today or yesterday? I was talking to somebody about developing a patent mm-hmm. for something that they use every day in their practice. Is that – it's interesting to hear about that, but I was wondering how common that is.
It's actually very common for nurses to have ideas to – impact patient care through the changing of a process that's currently done or a product that's currently done. When I actually go out and give my talks at innovation conferences, I usually ask everyone to stand in the room if they've had an idea that they think could impact patient care. And then I say, I want everyone to sit down who's had that same idea completed by someone else. And usually it's either a large medical supply company, a big pharma, someone else has taken their idea to fruition. And the point I try to make there is that we are the innovators at the bedside. There's actually a wonderful article about the impact of nurses as makers written by Jose Gomez Marquez and Anna Young out of MIT. And it explores how nurses have been tinkering and making at the bedside for years. But we also talk about how doing that at the bedside isn't enough, because if we're only doing that, we're only affecting our microorganism and not getting out to the macro level. And it doesn't necessarily just have to be nurse practitioners. This is for all nurses.
Anyone who – or anybody in the healthcare
industry? Anyone in the healthcare system, yes.
Yeah. They're not necessarily given the tools to run a business, though, or to develop a product, right?
No. From – and I believe dentistry does a little bit of a better job than this, but from medical school, nursing school, social work, all these health sciences, there's not a lot of business components to the traditional baccalaureate education. So we are trying to fix that by allowing our community to come to us for this workshop, whether you're a nurse, a social worker, physician, pharmacist, dentist, or just have interest in starting a healthcare business. We see that there's a lot of opportunity to use to collaborate interprofessionally to raise healthcare innovation. And we want to do that by giving you the tools and confidence in finance, marketing, the legal considerations that you need to go through, how to develop a business plan, how to pitch your ideas. All those types of things are things that we're not trained to do in health sciences, but something that is integral to being a successful entrepreneur or entrepreneur.
I was wondering about the financing part of it, because starting a practice is very, very expensive, mm-hmm. the equipment and so forth. How did you do that, Candy Reinhart?
I borrowed some, so I had a small business loan, saved up a lot, and purchased things as I went along. And when
the
money
wasn't
available.
Were you a single practitioner? You were alone in your practice?
No, I had other nurse practitioners that worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
So at times there was three or four of us. So
what was the biggest challenge?
I think most times it was, again, to define your role. Day to day, people would question, you can do this by yourself. You can have a business of your own without.
In other words, teach the public.
Exactly. For years and years, we've been doing that. We're doing better, but it still is a lot of teaching of the public as to, yes, we can provide these services and just to market. And then word of mouth was really my best friend. People would come to the practice and say, I really like the way they take care of me there. And the business just grew.
What was the name of your practice?
It was very clever, Reinhart Family Health.
Right. So at some point, did some people come in, they'd see the nurse and say, well, when do I get to see the doctor?
All the time. Or I still will get, so when are you going to be a doctor? When are you going to be done with school?
Uh-huh.
Like they still think that there's, I don't want to call it a hierarchy, but it's a process that you're a nurse practitioner before
and then
you become
get to be a doctor.
A doctor, be a physician.
How
yes.
long did you go to school?
Well, I do have a doctorate in nursing, but my original education was a baccalaureate in nursing. And then I was in the first class of nurse practitioners, our first master's program in Ohio. It was at Wright State.
What year was that?
I graduated in 1996.
Okay.
And same year as title recognition.
Right.
And then, so that was 2.5 years. 3 years, and then my doctoral degree, which was 2 more years.
Why was it important to you to become a nurse practitioner?
It truly was what I always wanted to do when I grew up, because I felt like I could make a difference in managing people's health. and being able to have that relationship. I grew up in a community with in a small community with a family physician who came to our home if we needed to, who delivered all the of us, my siblings and I, and then took care of us throughout our lifetime. And that's that caring approach, that way of caring for people. I loved it. It's what I knew. So it was just a matter of when could I do it in Ohio.
Is it more affordable too?
There's different ways to look at affordable, not to not answer you directly. A lot of times we're seen as more affordable because we do get paid less. And so with CMS or primary Medicare, we are paid 85% of the physician rate. Mm. So we are less costly to them. And CMS, you know, sets the standard and the trend.
CMS?
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
Okay, gotcha.
So they kind of set the standard. So other private insurances follow that same practice of paying 85% of what the physician rate would be. So that, again, is another barrier when you're opening your own practice that you are paid less, too, to provide those services to your
and
patients.
And we saw a trend in physicians moving away from primary care ownership over the last 10 to 15
mm-hmm.
years.
Right.
And a lot of that was because they weren't able to make the income that they were making prior or with the changes that came in healthcare. But with nurse practitioners, the salary gap is almost 50% of what a physician would make. You know, an average nurse practitioner makes somewhere between $85,000 to $105,000 per year, depending on how long they've been in practice and what their role is, which is significantly lower than what the physicians were making when they had their private
and
practice.
And that's a function of these federal rules?
No, it's actually a function of most of the time these people aren't entrepreneurs, so they're working within a health system.
Okay.
So they're getting paid what the health system is willing to pay them mm-hmm. instead of actually being paid based off of productivity and the amount of income that they're or revenue that they're generating for their health system.
So 85% is actually good compared to what most get.
Well, that's the reimbursement. So whether
okay.
you're employed okay. or whether you own your own practice, that's what the reimbursement is to take care of that patient for their visit or whatever you've done. Mm-hmm. It's going to be 85% of the physician rate.
Is it more affordable for somebody to have a nurse practitioner clinic or a practice, private practice, in a place that is less populated? I know in the rural areas, there's a big, huge problem. Not only is there nobody out there to treat them, but it's long distances to get to somebody. Mm-hmm. It's hard, particularly if you're aging, to travel on your own. But doctors say, well, I can't afford to have a practice out in a rural area. There's just not enough business to keep it going.
Correct.
What about nurse practitioners?
Well, I think the same thing would apply there
right.
of you have to have the patience to—
The economies of scale,
the
right?
economy of scale needs to exist. That being said, you know, the other aspects of economies of scale, what your rent is, what supplies you need for those areas, that may be less costly in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not able to bring patients in, then it becomes a challenge no matter what your education background is.
Before I let you go, Candy Reinhart, what do you see as the biggest challenges ahead as we approach this 2025 date where the physician shortage is going to be so acute?
I think just mainly the things we talked about, requiring any type of relationship with or physician oversight.
There's
going
to be fewer physicians. That means
right.
fewer people to
right.
collaborate with.
Right, and how many we can collaborate and the cost of collaboration. And then, of course, reimbursement will always be. But we do save money. We feel like we are cost-effective in the way we care for patients with the prevention aspects that we provide, the education that nurse practitioners are well-known to provide. In those ways, we think by keeping the population healthier, we're going to save healthcare costs, too.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Candy Reinhart. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
Candy Reinhart is a nurse practitioner at OSU Hospitals East. Also, Tim Radersdorf, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tim Radersdorf is the Chief Innovation Officer at Ohio State University College of Nursing and founder of the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Workshop for Health Professionals. He'll be holding a workshop, I think, in the next week or so. So if you want to learn more about that, check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be right back with more Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The soaring rate of diabetes in the U.S. and worldwide generally refers to type 2 diabetes, the most common form, the kind often related to lifestyle. The rarer form, type 1 diabetes, is commonly known as juvenile diabetes because it typically strikes during childhood. We wanted to know about the difference between the types of diabetes, how they're treated, and whether the search for a cure is the same. Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation's One Walk takes place to raise funds for research. For more information, go to the link at WOSU.org/allsides. I should say next week, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation's One Walk occurs to raise funds. So check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. One of the participants will be Dublin Jerome High School student Nick Ernst, who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 13. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Also joining us by phone is pediatric endocrinologist at Central Ohio Pediatric Endocrine and Diabetes Services, Dr. Jennifer Dyer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Great to be here.
Doctor, diabetes develops when the body doesn't make enough insulin or is not able to use insulin effectively, or both. What's the difference between type 1 and type 2?
Well, that's a really important question, Anne. Essentially, if when you have type 1 diabetes, you don't make any insulin. When you have type 2 diabetes, it first starts out by having a problem with your insulin functioning, and over time, that leads to not making any insulin.
And I just want to make sure I was accurate in describing type 2 as more of a lifestyle-related one. In other words, it's this activity, diet, you know, that kind of a thing.
Well, it is true. It's multifactorial. So if you have a genetic base for having type 2 diabetes, then it means that you don't have to gain very much weight and you can get diabetes.
Okay.
Certain genes are more potent than other genes. So actually in Asia, if you only gain about 5 pounds, you can get diabetes. But in America, if you tend to be Caucasian, you have to gain about 50 to 100 pounds. If you are American Indian, you gain 10 pounds and you can get diabetes.
Okay. When is a child typically diagnosed with type 1, where they have no insulin?
Well, there can be multiple ages where the kids can be diagnosed. It typically tends to cluster around the age of 6 to 11, as well as teenagers, just like Nick.
Mm-hmm. And are they born not producing insulin, or is it something that's just detected at a certain point? What's going on?
No, it's important to note that they were not born with it, and they didn't not do anything to cause the diabetes themselves. So there wasn't one sweet roll that they ate. It wasn't not exercising enough. It's an autoimmune disease. So what that means is that in Nick's body, when it probably happened a couple of years ago before he was diagnosed, that his body decided to attack the cells that make insulin. And so over time, his body compensated, but at a certain point, his body couldn't compensate anymore, and that's when he developed the symptoms.
Nick, what were the symptoms that first, you know, that you first noticed?
Well, at first, I didn't think for a second that I had diabetes, but I was thirsty all the time, and I actually lost a lot of weight over the course of a couple months. And I told my mom that, and she did some research that night, and then the next morning took me to the ER and telling me that I could possibly have diabetes, and I said, no, there's no way, but that morning's when I found out.
And is that pretty typical, Dr. Dyer?
It is. It would be extreme thirst, right, Nick? Like your mouth feeling really super dry.
Like cotton mouth all the time kind of a thing?
Yeah.
And also feeling really hungry, but still losing a lot of weight, feeling really tired, peeing a lot. That's definitely a frequent symptom.
I would imagine, Dr. Dyer, that a lot of it goes undetected until it becomes very dangerous because, you know, Nick had a good relationship with his mom. He had somebody who could tell. Lots of kids would probably just keep drinking more and more water and not necessarily report it.
You know what, Anne? It really can. And that's why the work that you're doing and getting the the knowledge out there about what the signs are is so important.
Now, I was attracted to this whole story because I saw a video about Nick Ernst on, I don't know where it was, YouTube or wherever it was. And it was about, I think, going to the point that he's trying to raise funds for juvenile diabetes research at this run next week. But it also explained how much you can do, Nick, that a lot of people maybe are unaware of. Tell me about a typical day now. You're 18 years old. You've been living with this for 5 years. What's it like typically? What do you do?
Well, when I first got diagnosed, it was very frustrating, and it was hard to keep a stable blood glucose, and that kind of got in the way of things I wanted to do. But the difference now is that it's really just a part of my daily routine, just like brushing your teeth. And what I have to do is check my blood glucose before every time I eat, and then also account for how many carbs are in the food that I eat and give insulin for that. And it's really kind of just a balancing act. I just have to pay close attention throughout the day.
And the insulin, as far as the carbs go, Dr. Dyer, it's breaking down the sugars and the carbohydrates?
Yes, it allows the body to use the carbohydrates and the fuel, but there are certain foods that you don't need insulin for that we call free foods, which are meats, proteins, and certain vegetables.
Okay, so your diet changed a lot, right, Nick?
Yeah, it did change a little bit. One thing I can't do now is I can't eat Pop-Tarts because I noticed that whenever I eat Pop-Tarts, it would really spike up my blood sugar. So that's one bad thing about it. But it didn't need to change too much. You know, I've learned more through experience about when to give insulin and how to correct for certain foods.
Can you feel it before you'd even test for it?
Well, when I get low blood sugar, I really do feel it, and it's not a good feeling. I get really dizzy and lightheaded. High blood sugar, sometimes it's harder to tell without checking, but when I get really high, I get dry mouth and kind of crampy.
Yeah, and yet you participate in sports. You've not let up, really?
No, I haven't. Sometimes it's difficult and frustrating with sports if I have to sit out of a football practice because of high or low blood sugar, but it's just something that I have to keep an open mind and just work through it.
Is football your sport, or do you participate in others?
I participate in football and baseball.
Dr. Dyer, is that pretty typical? If a young person wants to do these sports, are there any cautionary tales?
Well, we definitely encourage all kids to be involved in all activities. It really does help with blood sugars. But, you know, you're only a kid once, and you really need to live it up. And that's actually correlates with better control with diabetes, is just integrating diabetes into your life.
Nick Ernst, what did you think when you first found out that you had to go through all this rigmarole?
When I first found out, I was actually really shocked and scared because I didn't know something like this could happen to me. And I had a million questions. I didn't know if I was going to be able to live a normal life. I didn't know if I was going to be able to play sports anymore.
Yeah. And how did you start to wrap your brain around it? What helped?
Well, I just gained more and more experience. And at somewhere along the line, I realized that the only thing that was holding me back was not the diabetes. It was really just my mindset.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you? I mean, you were 13 when you found out. Mm-hmm. When did you start to feel at home with this?
I think.
And that ticked off.
I think going into that baseball season, you know, it was kind of tough to miss a lot of practice and stuff. And I got really frustrated at first, but just going through that season, I learned just to deal with it and move on.
You know, Dr. Dyer, when you're dealing with kids, I imagine Nick's probably pretty well organized, has his act together, but a lot of kids, you know, maybe they're kind of disorganized. This is a really serious problem. How do you work with them to help them establish these kind of grown-up habits that they have to deal with?
Well, the key word is a habit, and somebody that's in great control like Nick, who has, first of all, a great attitude, he's integrated diabetes into his life. And when you have good health habits, like brushing your teeth every day, it's not something that you think about. It's actually an automatic habit. So we've really been trying a couple of innovative measures here in our office to try to help those kids that don't have a habit like Nick. And in fact, we're making a new video game that's going to be coming out soon.
Like, what is it going to do?
Well, it's going to help you develop habits with bolusing and checking your blood sugar.
Video games are always good, always big. But Nick, there are good days and bad days, right? No matter what you do?
Of course, yeah.
A good day is practice, you know, go through the day, no problems, everything checks out. What's a bad day like?
Well, there's bad days where things happen with my blood sugar that are just completely unexpected, and I couldn't really control them.
You've done everything right.
Right, and there's some days where I'll be really high all day, and I'll be bolusing, giving myself insulin continuously, and it will just not go down, and that carries on into practice, and then I miss practice time, which is very frustrating. And the same goes with low blood sugar. Sometimes I'll keep getting low and keep eating, and then I'll just still go down.
And is there at a certain point where you have to go and see the physician?
Yeah. Numbers can be really high, get over 400 or 500, and that's when you want to check for ketones and, you know, see a doctor.
Yeah. And are you know, Dr. Dyer, are kids good about reporting this? Is that a big conversation you have to have? Come in and see me if there's a problem.
You know, we're really fortunate here at COPEDS that we are able to see any kids that need to come in right immediately. And fostering, it's important to foster a really good doctor-patient relationship so that everybody feels comfortable calling and letting us know. We're also on call after hours, so we do speak to several of our patients if they're having those kind of blood sugars in the night or on the weekend, and we can usually fix and address just about any problem.
Let's talk about the research. Nick's going to be in this. It's a run, I take it.
It's a walk. You could run it if you want, but it's listed
okay.
as a walk.
It's coming up next week. Again, we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. But we've talked about the differences between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Dr. Dyer, what's the difference in, is there a difference in the research that goes into these?
You know, there is a difference in the research. The cause of type 1 diabetes is autoimmune. So it has a lot to do with the cure would be changing the immune system. But a lot of the research that's being done with through JDRF, which is one of the leading organizations that's creating innovations in diabetes, have included quite a bit of technology as well as trying to find a cure. And this is a really, really exciting time as far as technology in diabetes is concerned, as well as a future cure, too. There are numerous upcoming research projects and ongoing research projects that are going to be affecting Nick's life directly.
What do you mean by technology? Can you give me an example?
Well, the delivery of insulin can be through an insulin pump, as well as checking blood sugars can be through a continuous glucose meter. And putting those two technologies together with a computer base is called an artificial pancreas. So that Nick can go about playing baseball and being a high school student and thinking about final exams and not having to control his blood sugars as much. That is on the horizon, and that is directly due to the research and funds being raised by JDRF.
Sounds like a good idea to you, Nick.
Oh, yeah, it's very exciting.
And what about a cure, ever?
Well, a cure, I think, is on the horizon, but as Nick can tell you, acting like a pancreas is very challenging, and the pancreas is a complicated organ, and trying to control the immune system is something that even cancer researchers haven't quite gotten, and that's what the challenge is, but I do think that there will be some technologies, smart insulins, that will eventually take over all function of a pancreas so that hopefully that will be almost like a cure.
Dr. Jennifer Dyer, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Dyer is a pediatric endocrinologist at Central Ohio Pediatric Endocrine and Diabetes Services, COPED for short. And Nick Ernst, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Nick Ernst is a senior at Dublin Jerome High School, discovered when he was 13 years old that he had type 1 diabetes. Appreciate him talking to us about it. Appreciate everybody out there listening. Thanks. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.